Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
One August night in 1993, Craig Fulbig was awakened from a deep sleep by the blood-curdling screams of his wife, Kathleen. He rushed into their baby daughter's room to find Kathleen standing over the cot. Their baby, Sarah, was dead and cold, her face white. Every parent's worst nightmare.
Even worse for Craig, this was not the first time he'd found Kathleen screaming over a dead child. Sarah was the third of the Fulbig children to die mysteriously in the middle of the night, but she would not be the last.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and this is Serial Killers. Today we're going to take a deep dive into the life of Kathleen Fulbig, an Australian serial killer infamous for murdering her four children. I'm here with my co-host, Vanessa Richardson. Vanessa isn't a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she's done a lot of research for this show.
Hi, everyone. We'd like to ask a quick favor. Would you leave a 5-star review of Serial Killers on your favorite podcast directory? It seems so simple, but it really helps us out.
And don't forget to subscribe while you're there, because a new episode comes out every Monday. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast, and on Twitter at Parcast Network, or on our website, parcast.com.
Kathleen Fulbig is Australia's most notorious female serial killer of the last several decades. She was active in the New South Wales region and murdered all four of her children over the course of 9 years, from 1991 through 1999.
Although the deaths of the first three Fulbig babies were originally attributed to sudden infant death syndrome, these diagnoses were later revised. Fulbig was convicted in 2003 of smothering all four of the children.
In part one of this podcast, we'll discuss Kathleen's troubled childhood, her marriage to Craig Fulbig, and the mysterious deaths of her first three children.
In part two, we'll uncover how the death of the last Fulbig baby led to a murder investigation that finally brought Kathleen to justice for her crimes. We'll also discuss the legal battle for her freedom and the ongoing debate over whether she is truly guilty of murder.
Kathleen Fulbig was born Kathleen Megan Donovan on June 14, 1967. Her father, T.J. Britton, was a Welshman who emigrated to Australia after World War II and worked on the docks. He was a notoriously violent, angry man who had several short-term relationships with various women.
He was infamous for his temper. An anonymous contact who knew Britton during his early years in Australia later told a Sydney newspaper that Britton attacked his boss at the docks and was once reprimanded for throwing a hammer at a blacksmith.
T.J. Britton had a side job as an enforcer and debt collector, breaking legs for Australian underworld bigwigs. He was widely feared, but still managed to draw women in.
Britton never stayed with one woman for long, and he fathered multiple children during the 60s. He was also a domestic abuser. He attacked his first wife with a knife before he met Fulbig's mother, Kathleen Donovan, in 1966.
Britton was guilty of intimate partner violence, commonly known as domestic abuse, many times over. He'd already served 8 months in prison for the attack on his first wife by the time he met Donovan. But he could appear very charming when he wished. Like many abusers, Britton had a bit of Jekyll and Hyde in him. He could seem suave and loving if he chose to, but he was quick to anger and used violence as a tool to control others.
Donovan was the perfect target for Britton. She struggled with alcohol and gambling addictions. And by the time she met Britton, she'd already abandoned her husband and two kids. Donovan and Britton both frequented bars on the wrong side of town, where they met. They never married, but despite their respective issues, Donovan and Britton stayed together for the better part of 2 years, and Donovan gave birth to baby Kathleen in June of 1967.
We don't know if Donovan drank while she was pregnant, but if she did, her daughter Kathleen would have been at risk for developing a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. According to the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, the condition affects about 40,000 infants each year and is the leading cause of developmental disabilities and birth defects in the U.S.
Any alcohol consumed during pregnancy can harm the infant, even if it's consumed in the early stages, before a woman even knows she's pregnant. The children of frequent drinkers are at the highest statistical risk of developing the disorder. And a 2018 study published in JAMA indicates that as many as 5% of U.S. children suffer from a range of fetal alcohol disorders.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders can result in behavior issues, memory deficits, and difficulty with reasoning and judgment. According to a New York Times interview with Dr. Chambers, one of the authors of the JAMA study, children suffering from severe fetal alcohol syndrome generally display distinctive physical characteristics. These include, quote, smaller than typical heads and bodies, as well as eyes unusually short in width, thin upper lips, and smoother than usual skin between the nose and mouth, end quote. But Dr. Chambers warns that children can also suffer from a more moderate condition called alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder. As the name implies, these children suffer from neurological impairment, but they don't display physical symptoms of their disorder. And since it can be difficult to spot the physical signs of a less severe alcohol spectrum disorder, it's a diagnosis that can be easily missed.
After Kathleen was born, her early home life was unstable. Her father was abusive and violent toward her mother, and Donovan allegedly turned to alcohol to deal with the abuse she received.
Children, even infants, can suffer serious psychological consequences after witnessing abuse at home. The Superior North Victim Safety Grant Project explains that infants can suffer from developmental delays and become terrified of loud noises.
On November 24, 1968, Donovan fled Britain's abuse. Britain would later attempt to character assassinate Donovan by claiming that she left with a bottle of alcohol and a week's worth of wages, with no intention of returning home for her daughter.
But in reality, Donovan was most likely desperately trying to escape Britain's terrifying abuse. In fact, Moya O'Brien, a friend of Donovan's, later confirmed that Donovan left to escape Britain's daily death threats and that she had every intention of rescuing her daughter from her abusive husband.
Moya recounted to reporters 35 years later, quote, "That baby was mother's little girl. Her mom used to carry her around everywhere on her hip. I think everyone should know that she was a good mother. Her father was the monster," end quote.
But Britain wasn't about to let Donovan escape. According to data collected during the CDC's National Violence Against Women survey, the end of a relationship often incites an escalation in intimate partner violence. Interviews with men who have murdered their partners show that, quote, "threats of separation or actual separation are most often the precipitating events that lead to murder," end quote. This is because intimate partner violence is about control, and when Donovan tried to flee from Britain, she left his control.
So in the winter of 1968, Britain began hunting Kathleen down. Over the next week, Britain dropped young Kathleen off at his friend Charles Budden's house while he stalked Donovan and beat her. He once saw Donovan out the window of a bus and jumped out after her and verbally abused her in the middle of the street.
But this horrific abuse was just Britain getting warmed up. According to domesticshelters.org, signs that an abuser will kill include, among other factors, quote, an escalation of abuse, abuse that occurs in a public place, suicide or homicide threats, and plans to carry out either, stalking and substance abuse, end quote. Britain was displaying all of these signs.
On December 8, 1968, about 2 weeks after Donovan fled Britain's violence, Britain came after her again. He drank several beers before tracking Donovan down. He found her at Moya O'Brien's home, where she was staying. Britain's violent reputation was well known. Yet no one did anything to stop Britain as he stabbed Donovan 24 times, right in the middle of the street, with a carving knife.
Moya O'Brien witnessed Britain verbally abusing Donovan and calling her a slut, even as he killed her.
Elizabeth Lorick, a neighbor, witnessed the incident from her front yard. She told police, quote, "I saw a man with a knife in his right hand. I saw him push the knife into her left breast," end quote.
Britain stabbed Donovan to death in the street. According to a 2003 to 2014 study by the CDC, homicide is one of the leading causes of death for women under the age of 44. Of the 3,519 women and girls murdered in 2015, nearly half of victims are killed by a current or former male intimate partner. Donovan sadly became one of many young women killed by an abusive partner.
Britain was immediately arrested, and in May of 1969, he was sentenced to life in prison for Donovan's murder. However, he only served 14 years of his sentence before being deported back to his native Wales, where he integrated back into his old life, concealing the fact that he had killed his wife and lost custody of his daughter.
Kathleen was only about 1.5 years old when her father murdered her mother. Too young to remember either of her parents, she had only a vague notion that her mother had been killed, but none of the details, and she never had any more contact with Britain during his life.
After Donovan's murder, Kathleen was placed with a foster couple for a few days. Then, at 1 year old, she was moved to Bedura Children's Home, an orphanage for wards of the state, in July 1970.
The New South Wales foster system noted that baby Kathleen was often disconnected and had trouble adjusting. When she showed emotions at all, it was in the form of uncontrollable anger or sadness. Kathleen was a baby while her father was abusing her mother, but as we've mentioned, even very young children can be psychologically affected by witnessing abuse. The U.S. Children's Bureau explains that young children often have no understanding of how to externalize their negative emotions. They develop anxieties and fears of abandonment and may experience difficulty in social interactions. Baby Kathleen clearly showed she was having difficulty interacting with others.
In September that year, Kathleen was removed from the home and placed with her long-term foster family, the Marlboroughs. Neville and Deirdre Marlborough already had a 15-year-old daughter of their own, Leah, but were happy to foster 3-year-old Kathleen as well. Leah later described young Kathleen as an adorable child. We all loved her to bits.
Deirdre and Neville had previously taken in temporary foster children from their church, but were financially unable to adopt. When Kathleen came from the government to stay long-term, the Marlboroughs gladly accepted.
While Kathleen was never formally adopted by the Marlboroughs, she was never excluded from family events. The Marlboroughs took her on several family vacations around Australia and the world.
Kathleen was a pretty child with blonde hair, but she wasn't extroverted. She kept most of her thoughts and emotions to herself. Kathleen's schoolmates later described her as a quiet and average student.
As Kathleen grew, so did her curiosity about her birth parents. But the Marlboroughs were not forthcoming with any answers. According to Kathleen, her questions were met with brick walls in my face as her foster family attempted to keep the terrible truth of her origins from her.
Their unwillingness to reveal what happened to Kathleen's mother led to tension in the family, and Kathleen was forced to research her parents on her own. Kathleen's and Deirdre's relationship apparently grew strained as Kathleen got older, although their accounts of these years differ. Kathleen insists that she was treated poorly, made to do labor, and not allowed to see her friends very often.
All this tension came to a head in 1982, when 15-year-old Kathleen ran away from the Marlboroughs' home, dropped out of Katara High School, and struck out on her own. She set out to finally learn the truth about her parents. She managed to track down her maternal uncle, who revealed that her father had murdered her mother.
In 1997, psychologists Thomas Styron and Ronnie Janoff Bullman conducted a study on the long-term effects of domestic abuse and the murder of a parent on grown-up children. Surprisingly, they found that decades after the homicide, adult survivors often exhibited a surprising lack of anger towards the perpetrator and sometimes blamed the victim for destroying the family. Kathleen made no attempt to contact her father directly after learning the truth about him, but she did later write in her diary that she understood him on some level. Quote, "Obviously, I am my father's daughter," end quote.
After learning the truth about Britton and Donovan, Kathleen didn't return home. Instead, she got an apartment across town and worked a series of dead-end jobs throughout the early 1980s. She spent time working the cash register at a gas station and waitressing at an Indian restaurant. In 1985, she met a steelworker and car fanatic named Craig Fulbig. She was 18, he was 23. Craig and Kathleen began dating, going out drinking and dancing together. Craig found Kathleen fun, carefree, and sexy, and was quickly smitten with her. They moved in together after 1 year in 1986.
In May of 1987, they took a big step forward and moved into a new home together in Newcastle, New South Wales. A few months later, in September of 1987, the couple got married. 2 years later, 20-year-old Kathleen got pregnant.
Not everyone was so pleased with their union. Deirdre Marlborough, Kathleen's foster mother, had an early falling out with Craig Fulbig that persisted throughout the rest of the young couple's relationship. According to Kathleen, things fell apart during the wedding planning process when Craig wanted to hire his brother's catering service, but Deirdre objected.
She recalled, quote, "It became a power struggle between Deirdre and Craig as to who was going to do what, and they sort of snapped one day and had an argument both in front of me and Dad," end quote. The disagreement rekindled the tension in Kathleen's recently repaired relationship with her foster parents.
2 years after Kathleen married Craig, she gave birth to their first child, Caleb Gibson, on February 1st, 1989. But instead of bringing her joy, the birth of Kathleen's first child would lead her down the path to murder.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message.
And now, let's continue our story. On February 1st, 1989, Kathleen Fulbig gave birth to her first child, Caleb. It was a difficult birth that lasted almost 18 hours. Problems with the epidural gave Kathleen chronic pain for almost a month afterwards.
Caleb was a relatively healthy baby, though he did occasionally gasp for air while eating, a trait his pediatrician attributed to a floppy larynx. Dr. Barry Springthorpe assured the Fulbigs that Caleb would eventually grow out of the issue.
Kathleen did not like breastfeeding and found it uncomfortable. But she persevered for a while because Caleb's doctors stressed the importance of breast milk for a baby. She eventually gave up and switched to formula.
Kathleen also liked to keep diaries. She wrote journal entries about her thoughts and feelings throughout her journey through motherhood. She made no real effort to conceal these journals from her husband, even though they contained some of her deepest fears and darkest thoughts.
Kathleen wrote in her diaries that she did not like the feeling of being sidelined by a new baby who took all the attention off of her. She felt abandoned, as she had felt as a foster child, quote, "in a family, but never part of it," end quote.
It's possible that this feeling of dissatisfaction was a symptom of postnatal depression, a depressive mental illness affecting up to 15 out of every 100 new mothers. It can manifest as depression, irritability, anxiety, hopelessness, and even occasionally psychosis. The condition has become a big enough concern that in a meeting in 2008, the Australian government agreed to launch an initiative encouraging hospitals to screen for postnatal depression in new mothers. Even so, it's important to note that most women who develop postnatal depression or postpartum psychosis do not act on their feelings and never harm their children.
Just 19 days after Caleb's birth in February of 1989, Kathleen claimed that Caleb's cries woke her in the middle of the night. Craig, who was a heavy sleeper, was not roused. Kathleen fed Caleb and went back to bed. Several hours later, Kathleen rose again and went back to check on baby Caleb. But it was too late. Caleb was dead. Kathleen claimed that she scooped up the baby and screamed for Craig. Her husband came running and called the 000 emergency number.
But Craig's version of events is slightly different. He woke around 2 a.m. to Kathleen screaming, quote, "My baby, something is wrong with my baby," end quote. But when he rushed into the nursery, Kathleen was not holding Caleb. Instead, the baby was still in his crib, wrapped in a blanket, dead, but not yet cold. At the time, Craig was too panicked to notice anything odd about Kathleen's behavior. But in later years, he would look back on this moment and wonder why Kathleen was not already trying to revive Caleb by the time he arrived on the scene.
Kathleen later stated that she had only a vague memory of her first child's death. Quote, "From once I actually found him and realized that something wasn't actually quite right, it's all just a blur. There's only sort of bits and pieces that stick in my mind after that," end quote.
Emergency responders David Hopkins and Richard Baines found Craig and Kathleen crying over their dead son when the ambulance arrived. They attempted resuscitation, but were eventually forced to pronounce Caleb dead. With no obvious signs of violence or illness apparent in his autopsy, Caleb was declared a victim of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome.
According to the CDC, sudden infant death syndrome is a catch-all classification for unexplained infant deaths. Even today, about 3,500 babies die of SIDS each year. These are deaths with no obvious medical cause and no apparent signs of wrongdoing.
Babies are delicate enough in the first few months of their existence that it is accepted by the worldwide medical community that sometimes we simply don't know why they died. It could be any number of tiny things. Caleb Folbig fell into this non-category, victim of an unexplained death.
That is the horrific aspect of SIDS. You have a seemingly healthy child, and you have them healthy 1 minute, and the next minute it's as if somebody turned off the switch and they're gone. And why?
One of the reasons SIDS is difficult to diagnose is because of the challenge in differentiating sudden infant death syndrome from the signs of smothering. Smothering, or the intentional and criminal suffocation of a child, often presents the same signs as SIDS in autopsy. Both often present as unexplained asphyxia. Since infants are too weak to resist an attempt on their lives, there are no signs of struggle to help differentiate an accidental suffocation from a homicide.
In addition, many SIDS deaths are due to unexplained asphyxiation. Without any obvious signs of violence, it is often impossible to discern between smothering and accidental asphyxiation of an infant.
Some parents may be getting away with murder.
15% of all children who die of SIDS are really infanticides.
That's what criminal prosecutors tell Adrian Haville on the murder of babies suffocated while they slept. They say too many pathologists are willing to write off unexplained deaths as SIDS.
It's really a non-diagnosis. When doctors say a child has died of SIDS, and generally a child dies of SIDS between the second and the sixth month after birth, they're really saying, we don't know what caused this child to die.
But the medical examiner had no reason to suspect either of the Folbigs of murdering their son. So the death was recorded as SIDS. A SIDS counselor at the hospital explained to the Folbigs that SIDS was still fairly misunderstood by the medical community, but seldom happened twice in the same family. She encouraged them to try for another baby once they were ready.
A police officer came to talk to the Folbigs after Caleb's death, but he did not ask them any pressing questions. He was mostly there to offer condolences, not accusations. Kathleen wasn't under suspicion, yet.
After Caleb's death, Craig grieved for weeks. He had to call all their relatives back and let them know the bad news. But as Craig wallowed in grief, he noticed that Kathleen seemed to snap back from the tragedy quickly. She went back to her old job at a restaurant and went out with friends. She appeared to Craig to be freer and happier, like she'd been when they first met. This grieving period is when Craig first started to have doubts about Kathleen. She never wanted to spend any time with his siblings' children, and he wondered if she simply didn't like babies.
Kathleen's apparent indifference could have been evidence of the coping mechanism known as avoidance behavior. The National Institute of Health explains that avoidance, quote, allows some respite from intense pain in order for the individual to process the loss and restore a satisfying ongoing life, end quote. But the grief must be confronted at some point, and too much avoidance can lead to chronic grief issues just as much as over-exploring one's loss can. Craig was aware that everyone grieves differently, and she had been very attentive to Caleb, so Craig decided Kathleen's carefree attitude was a coping mechanism and put away his doubts.
In late 1989, a few months after Caleb's death, the Fulbigs decided to try again to start a family. In anticipation of their second child's arrival, Kathleen and Craig followed the SIDS prevention advice of the day and renovated their home to make it safer and more hospitable for a new baby. They painted, recarpeted, and insulated the drafty old sunroom where Caleb had slept. On June 3, 1990, Kathleen began going into labor with her second child. She could not contact Craig at work, so Craig's brother, Greg, drove her to the hospital.
Kathleen's son, Patrick Allen, was born healthy. Craig stayed home for 3 months with Kathleen and the baby to help watch over Patrick. Initially, Patrick woke Kathleen up just as frequently as Caleb had woken her before his death. But by the time Patrick was 3 months old, he was only waking up once a night. In other words, he was doing well.
Craig thought Kathleen was a wonderful mother, and she appeared to be enjoying the role. But after 3 months, Craig had to go back to work. In the fall of 1990, he accepted a job at a car dealership. Patrick was alone with his mother.
Kathleen struggled to watch over Patrick alone all day long and had, quote, mixed feelings whether or not I was going to cope as a mother and whether I was going to get stressed out like I did last time, end quote. She wrote in her diary that, quote, I often regret Caleb and Patrick only because your life changes so much and maybe I'm not a person who likes change, end quote. This reaction could perhaps have been another sign of postpartum depression. And according to Andrew Solomon, a writer for the New York Times, quote, in the last two decades, it has become widely accepted that postpartum depression, which can make mothers both inattentive and irritable, is dangerous, end quote.
For a while, 3.5-month-old Patrick seemed healthy and happy. At 10 p.m. on October 18th, Craig checked on Patrick. The baby seemed to be sleeping well.
But a few hours later, at 3:30 a.m., Craig woke to a horrific sound. Kathleen was screaming over the baby's bed. Strangely, rescuers later could not find any evidence that Kathleen tried any sort of resuscitation on the baby before Craig ran into the room. Craig was not formally trained in CPR, but he still managed to resuscitate Patrick and save his life.
Kathleen called for an ambulance, but before the EMTs arrived, she also placed three other mysterious calls to unknown recipients. The EMTs gave Patrick oxygen therapy. Kathleen noted that the baby's eyes shot open, and he seemed more responsive.
Patrick regained consciousness at the hospital, surrounded by doctors, his parents, and his relatives. Doctors performed an exhaustive set of tests on Patrick, looking for any genetic disorder that could have contributed to his near-death experience and his brother's SIDS. They found nothing.
In the end, the doctors diagnosed Patrick with viral encephalitis, a swelling of the brain, and attributed his asphyxia to the illness. However, they found no concrete proof that this illness had caused Patrick to stop breathing.
Sadly, Patrick's brain was deprived of oxygen for too long during the period when he ceased breathing. The damage was severe. Patrick was now blind and experienced epileptic fits. Kathleen and Craig took Patrick home, where Kathleen had increasing trouble dealing with the challenges of Patrick's new disabilities. She didn't just have to deal with the everyday stresses of caring for a young baby. She also had the added stress of dealing with Patrick's dozens of doctor visits, medications, and all the advice from physiotherapists and blind experts. Kathleen wrote in her diary that she felt that she was on autopilot, not living her own life, just walking through all the necessary steps to care for Patrick. She often brought the baby to a neighbor's house or to Craig's sister, Carol Newitt, to babysit just to get a break.
Craig was happy to perform all the new routines necessary to help Patrick. He was just so happy the boy had survived. But he noticed that Kathleen seemed to regard Patrick's care more as a series of chores than a way to keep her baby alive. Kathleen insisted she was fine, but Craig noticed that she wasn't dealing with the stress as well as she seemed to think she was. She lost her temper frequently with both him and Patrick, and would clench her fists and growl when she got angry.
It put a strain on their relationship. With all of their energy spent on caring for their disabled son, the Fulbigs didn't have any time for each other. Craig's sister, Carol, who took care of Patrick when Kathleen got overwhelmed, thought her sister-in-law was struggling with the prospect of a whole lifetime of dealing with Patrick's handicaps.
Kathleen was shut down and withdrawn, so Craig turned to Kathleen's diaries to find out how she was really doing. It was the first time he read her inner thoughts. Kathleen confessed to the diary that she could not handle the stresses of raising Patrick and was seriously considering leaving both Craig and the baby.
This instinct to flee is fairly common amongst the parents of severely disabled children and is not unique to Kathleen. A 2004 study on antecedent consequence conditions in maternal mood and child adjustment by Elgar, McGrath, Curtis, and Stewart found that the mothers of disabled children suffer very high levels of depression and distress. They sometimes feel responsible for their child's struggles. They either fear that they cannot provide the appropriate care, or they blame themselves for failing to produce a healthy child in the first place. According to her diary entries, Kathleen worried that she was not capable of giving Patrick the care he needed. Kathleen thought that she was only harming Craig and Patrick by sticking around, and that they'd both be better off without her.
In any case, Craig and Carol managed to talk Kathleen out of leaving. They staged an intervention in January of 1991 to counsel Kathleen and convince her that Patrick needed his mother nearby. She agreed to stay, and the crisis seemed over.
But just 1 month later, on February 13th, 1991, Kathleen discovered 8-month-old Patrick dead in his crib.
We'll return to our story in just a moment.
And now, back to serial killers. On February 13th, 1991, Kathleen Fulbig found her second child, Patrick, dead in his crib. She called Craig at work, crying, quote, "It's happened again," end quote. Kathleen later claimed that she mentally blocked out most of the day that Patrick died. She told investigators later that, quote, "With Patrick, it's the whole day, the whole death, the whole sort of thing. I have pretty much just blocked it," end quote.
Craig rushed home, just in time to see the ambulance leave. The autopsy report attributed his death to asphyxia, probably due to his epilepsy.
But Craig disagreed with the coroner's assessment that Patrick had asphyxiated after an epileptic fit. Patrick had been getting better before his death, his seizures fewer and farther between, but with no other explanation forthcoming, he was forced to accept the official diagnosis.
The Fulbigs and Marlboroughs came to console the couple at the hospital, and Deirdre Marlborough held her foster daughter in her arms. Craig would not accept anyone's condolences. He was too distraught.
Each time a child died, Kathleen displayed a standard pattern of behavior that Craig later referred to as her, quote, "broken sparrow routine," end quote. She screamed bloody murder over the bodies of her dead babies and helplessly wrung her hands.
But Kathleen would gather herself together quickly. She would soon remove all pictures and mementos of the children from their house, as if wiping the slate clean. She made an effort not to mention the dead children's names again. Craig tried to talk over their feelings, but Kathleen shut him down. Quote, "I tried many, many times to coax Kathy into conversations, and she would not talk about those babies," end quote.
Craig felt that Kathleen was moving on too quickly, but it's important to remember that everyone grieves differently. Some, like Craig, find comfort in remembering their lost loved ones and reliving the good times. Others avoid all references to the loss and attempt to move on quickly to lessen the emotional impact of the loss. The National Institute of Health says that avoidance is not necessarily a bad response to grief. It's only harmful when one pushes off the grief indefinitely. Perhaps Kathleen's early childhood experiences and history of loss prevented her from ever revisiting Patrick's death and completing the grieving process. So she wiped Patrick from her mind in order to go on with her life.
Kathleen moved on after Patrick's death by getting a new job, ironically at Baby Co., an Australian store catering to babies and toddlers. But Craig was mired in grief. He lost his job, he didn't go out, and stayed home most of the time. He said, quote, "The world pretty much stopped for me. Didn't really see any sort of sunshine. Sort of went into myself. Spent a lot of my time in my garage. Pretty much kept away from a lot of people, and that's how I am. And Kath just gets on with things," end quote.
The couple fought over their different ways of grieving. Craig felt Kathleen was not upset enough over their son's death. Kathleen felt Craig was wallowing and needed to move on. In an effort to reconcile and save their marriage, Craig let Kathleen drag him out to parties and bars so he would be able to spend more time with her, though he did not feel like socializing.
In late 1991, the Fulbigs moved to a new house in Thornton, a town to the northwest of their old home in Newcastle. They were looking to start over and get away from all the bad memories of their previous home. Shortly after they moved in, Kathleen surprised Craig by declaring that she wanted another baby. She believed their family was not complete without a child. Craig was adamantly opposed to the idea. He couldn't face another dead child ever again. It wasn't worth the risk.
But Kathleen and Carol worked on Craig, and eventually his desire to be a father won out. He caved and agreed to try for another child under the condition that they consult SIDS experts all along the way.
On October 14, 1992, 1 year after Patrick's tragic demise, Kathleen gave birth to her first daughter, Sarah Kathleen Fulbig. The baby was diagnosed with mild sleep apnea early on, so Kathleen and Craig obtained a sleep monitor for her and kept the bassinet in their bedroom in order to keep a closer watch over her.
But Kathleen soon found that she hated the monitor. It woke her up with false alarms all the time, and she wished she could throw the machine out the window. The alarm went off every time Sarah held her breath or shifted, waking Kathleen up every few hours for months. Craig, on the other hand, easily slept right through the alarms. She called baby Sarah the catnapper due to her inability to stay asleep longer than a half hour at a time. Craig found the alarms reassuring. At least they would not be surprised by an asphyxia incident again. But the chronic lack of sleep was taking its toll on Kathleen, and her anxiety was worsened by constant exhaustion. She resented Craig's ability to sleep through the baby monitor alarms and felt he didn't appreciate how she was suffering.
The couple fought over Sarah's bedtimes, too. Kathleen, who had always been a very regimented person, wanted their daughter to sleep at exactly 8:30 p.m. This was complicated by Craig's habit of playing with Sarah every night after work. Kathleen felt he was riling her up before bedtime.
Kathleen later recalled that Sarah was a, quote, "very loud player. There was lots of screaming and laughing, and they would always be trying to chase each other around," end quote. After playing with her father, Sarah was nearly impossible to put down to sleep at night.
In 1993, Sarah was thriving. She had survived for 10 and a half months, much longer than her deceased siblings. She was doing well enough that Kathleen successfully lobbied Craig to stop using the sleep apnea monitor.
Kathleen was older and better at dealing with her darker moods. She was learning to walk away from the crying baby or to drop her off with a relative when the stress became too great.
But Kathleen took to dropping Sarah off with Craig's sister Carol so frequently that she was spending most of her time away from the baby. When Carol Newitt's husband told Kathleen that she was missing out on her daughter's life by pawning her off on relatives, Kathleen began to stay home with the girl again. But as 1993 progressed, Kathleen once again felt overwhelmed by the stresses of motherhood, and Craig began observing signs of Kathleen's dark moods.
Kathleen wrote in her diaries that she and Craig were at each other's throats. She was constantly afraid Craig would leave her. She noticed that he flirted with other women and rejected her advances while she was fat with pregnancy weight. She wrote, quote, "Craig's roving eye will always be of concern to me. Must lose extra weight, or he will be even less in love with me than he is now. I know that physical appearance means everything to him," end quote. Kathleen resented that the baby ate up all of her time, keeping her away from the gym and the path to repairing her marriage.
Kathleen was still just 26 years old, and all of her adult life had been spent with Craig. Since the falling out with her foster family over the wedding, Kathleen had become wrapped up in Craig's family. She relied heavily on his sister Carol for help with the childcare, and the Fulbigs spent most of their vacation time with Craig's sisters and brothers. To lose Craig would be to lose her entire new family.
On August 28, 1993, Kathleen and Craig once again fought over Sarah's fussiness and inability to sleep soundly. Her constant crying in the night was taking its toll on Kathleen's anxiety and on her relationship with Craig.
They needed some time away, so the Fulbigs brought their little girl to the beach that day. Sarah had a cold, but she still enjoyed the waves and the sand. It was a good day out for all of them.
But that night, Sarah was fussy. She kept Kathleen awake for most of the night after they put her to bed. Hours later, at 1:20 a.m. on August 29, 1993, Craig was once again awoken in the dead of night by Kathleen's screams. In what had become a nightmarish routine, Craig found his daughter Sarah cold in her bassinet. Craig noticed that Sarah's body was unusually straight, her limbs all down by her sides rather than all crooked as they'd usually be. He also noted the time as 1:20 a.m. on August 29th. Strangely, Kathleen later recorded 1 o'clock a.m. as the time of death in her diary. This discrepancy could simply mean that one of them remembers the time incorrectly, or it could mean that Kathleen knew Sarah was dead for 20 minutes before alerting Craig.
Officer Deborah McDermott responded to the 000 call, radioed for backup, and took over the resuscitation efforts for 40 minutes before breaking the bad news to the Fulbigs. Sarah was dead.
Sarah's autopsy showed signs of minor congestion and watery fluid in her lungs. The coroner also noticed tiny abrasions near Sarah's mouth. These symptoms were all consistent with both smothering and SIDS. With no other obvious cause of death present in the autopsy, Sarah's death was attributed to SIDS.
This time, though, the police were more wary. Losing one child to SIDS was unfortunate, but the Fulbigs had now lost three children in a row. Detective Stephen Saunders questioned the Fulbigs, and he was struck by the couple's obvious grief and distress at the death of their third child.
Craig gave as much information as he could to the detective, but Kathleen was sobbing too hard to answer many of the questions. She said later of that night, the police, quote, "sort of came in full force. We were a little intimidated by it," end quote.
Detective Saunders found nothing amiss with the couple. Since the coroner had already diagnosed Sarah with SIDS, the case was closed, and the Fulbigs were given full permission to bury their daughter.
One reason for the authorities' initial investigation into Sarah's death was because in the mid-1990s, the medical and law enforcement community's attitudes towards SIDS deaths were changing.
Methods for identifying and preventing SIDS were being discovered and implemented all over the world. The number of SIDS deaths in the first world countries had dropped drastically in the last several decades, and authorities began to view multiple SIDS deaths in the same family as highly suspicious.
Earlier in 1993, Sir Roy Meadow, a British pediatrician, testified at trial that Beverly Allitt, a nurse, had smothered four children in her care, and that it was statistically impossible for all four deaths to have been caused by SIDS. Meadows famously said that, quote, one SIDS case is a tragedy, two suspicious, and three is murder unless there is proof to the contrary, end quote. This saying, which became known as Meadows' Law, was based upon the extreme statistical improbability of SIDS striking multiple children in the same family.
Meadows pointed to 42 cases of SIDS deaths that were later revealed to be homicides, saying that, quote, SIDS has been used at times as a pathological diagnosis to evade awkward truths, end quote. Meadows' Law was cited by the prosecution in several cases all over the world in the next decade, as caregivers of multiple SIDS cases were convicted. However, it's important to note that Meadows' Law was later recognized as nothing more than an unproven assumption. Prosecutors were no longer allowed to cite this assertion in court. But during the time that the Fulbig children were dying, prosecutors were still applying Meadows' Law to cases where multiple children in one family died of SIDS.
After Sarah's death in August of 1993, the Fulbigs' marriage degraded. Craig was the only one still searching for answers. He wanted to know more about what Kathleen had observed the night Sarah had died. But Kathleen did not want to discuss the tragedy and never spoke to Craig about it again.
In 1995, 2 years after Sarah's death, Craig was still not coping well with his grief. But Kathleen was ready to move on with her life. She wrote Craig a 2-page letter of ultimatum. Either he would seek grief counseling or she would leave.
This was not the first time she'd threatened to leave him. Craig and Kathleen had separated and reconciled multiple times over the past 2 years, but Craig could not lift himself out of the fog of grief, so Kathleen moved out.
Kathleen's foster mother, Deirdre, helped her rent an apartment and start over without Craig. Kathleen noted that ever since their fight over the wedding planning, Deirdre had always been, quote, quick to judge and put Craig down with his changing of jobs and all that sort of thing. End quote. While Craig and Kathleen were separated, she began to grow closer to Craig's other sister, Sherry. Sherry brought out the fun side of Kathleen and helped her revert to an easier, carefree time before all the tragedies. They went out to bars and clubs together. Sherry got Kathleen into Jenny Craig, and Kathleen lost a lot of the weight she'd put on in the last few years.
Seeing Kathleen moving on without him finally motivated Craig to seek grief counseling. Kathleen said, quote, he seemed to snap out of it slightly and must have thought, my God, she's actually gone. He began calling and visiting Kathleen. They went to couples counseling together. By 1996, they were ready to give the marriage another try. To help with the fresh start, the Fulbigs moved to Hunter Valley in the wine country region of New South Wales. They wanted to forget the past.
Kathleen didn't tell the Marlboroughs about her reconciliation with Craig, but Deirdre eventually found out through the grapevine. She never forgave Kathleen for it. Kathleen said, quote, my parents pretty much disowned me once they discovered that Craig and I hadn't actually truly broken up, and Deirdre hasn't spoken to me since, end quote.
Kathleen's foster parents moved to a new house and didn't tell Kathleen where they moved, which hurt her deeply. But she blocked out the pain of this loss and tried to forge a new life with Craig.
Despite all their losses, everything finally seemed back on track for Kathleen and Craig. But tragedy still lurked. And soon, the Fulbigs would experience the untimely death of yet another child.
And this time, the police wouldn't let it go. Next week, we'll take a closer look at Laura Fulbig's death and Kathleen's conviction for murder. We'll uncover what finally tipped off the police and earned Kathleen Fulbig her notoriety as one of Australia's worst female serial killers. Thanks again for tuning in to Serial Killers.
If you want to listen to any previous episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify, or on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com.
If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review or tell us what you think on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram as @Parcast and Twitter @ParcastNetwork. It seems simple, but it really helps our show.
Have a killer week.
Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Colleen Brady and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson.